From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about Wisconsin state bird, the robin. Then, we'll learn the science behind the summer solstice, which is this Friday.
It kind of looks like it's still, which is why it's called solstice, that the moment here the sun is paused, it's northernward motion, and then it starts moving south.
Plus, we'll tell you about the Madison musical tradition of concerts on the square.
On concert night, more or less every square inch of the lawn is covered by a blanket. So patrons will come out at 2 in the afternoon or 3 in the afternoon to reserve their seat on the lawn by placing a blanket.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. It's Juneteenth, a day that commemorates the final enslaved people in the U.S. learning they'd been freed. Juneteenth became a federally recognized holiday in 2021, but Milwaukee was one of the first northern cities to start celebrating Juneteenth and has one of the longest-running Juneteenth Day celebrations. Here's WUWM's Taryn Powell speaking with Dr. Robert Baker, a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the African and African Diaspora Studies Department, about the holiday's origins and history.
What do you know about how those early celebrations looked?
Yeah, it was a celebration of food, singing, and joy. I mean, obviously, a year after slavery, people weren't rolling up in the Harley Davidsons or on their motorcycles or coming out in super fancy clothes, but it was a time of remembrance and hope. And so that first Juneteenth day, which is this June and 19th smashed together, that first Juneteenth day kicked off a cultural practice that started in the South and really pushed throughout the South, throughout and the North after the Great Migration in 1971. In Milwaukee, we have our first Juneteenth celebration. So I can imagine it was a time of hope and love. Mm.
And so you mentioned just that those celebrations traveling from the South to the North, and Milwaukee has been one of the cities that I believe has one of the longest Juneteenth celebrations. What do you think that says about Milwaukee that this festival has been able to succeed this long?
Yeah, I mean, the beautiful thing about Milwaukee is that we have a lot of love, hope, and pride and connection to our Black culture. And even though African Americans didn't start moving to Milwaukee until the late 50s, what you see by 1970 is an explosion of our Black community. And so as African Americans were coming north, they settled. This is one of the best places in the country for Blacks to be. And so I think it was a celebration of hope, freedom, but also about Black success. Mm. So I think we still have a lot of successful, freedom-loving Black people, and we're going to show up on King Drive until we can't.
Absolutely. So Juneteenth finally became a federally recognized holiday in 2021. Joe Biden signed the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act into law. And, you know, that was thanks to some Black women like Opal Lee and Lula Briggs Galloway, and other supporters who just really advocated for years for that to become a reality. What do you think is the significance of this federal acknowledgement?
Yeah, I mean, the last federal holiday was in 1993, and it was Martin Luther King Day. And so we fast forward, you know, over 30 years, and we have Juneteenth Day. And I think it's about a statement by the federal government that African Americans are just now finally getting acknowledged. Their history is just finally getting acknowledged. And while we're grateful for President Biden for passing this holiday, it shows that Black people in this country have to struggle to get acknowledged. Shouldn't have taken that long.
Mm. And so why do you think it took till 2021 for Juneteenth to be federally recognized?
I think it took so long for Juneteenth to be recognized because even though a lot of our population has moved on and is acknowledge that racism and racial oppression is something that is still exists today, there are many leaders who want to hide from our past. And even today, we're seeing a lot of people sort of put down Black history and some of the critical thought that's connected to it. And so I think there's a resistance to acknowledge that African-Americans have a different history in the United States. July 4th, 1776, many of us were still in bondage. At the end of slavery, 4 million Black people are still enslaved. And so it was a resistance and the slow moving nature of accepting our story. But, you know, Black people, we turn up. And so we know what happened in 2021.
Absolutely. And that's actually what my next question was, is like those events of 2020 with George Floyd being killed and the country having what some called a racial reckoning. You think that helped push that effort for federal acknowledgement?
Yeah, I think that if there had not been the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter moment and movement that took place after the death of George Floyd, I don't think President Biden would have set the federal holiday. And, you know, Frederick Douglass, our great ancestor, said that there is no progress without struggle. You know, and so I think that every time Black people and our allies and people who are concerned about racism and oppression step up and use our voice in unison, that's when we get stuff done.
Dr. Robert Baker is a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the African and African Diaspora Studies Department. He spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, in 2023. Milwaukee's Juneteenth celebration is happening until 4 p.m. on MLK Drive. While you're there, be sure to stop by WUWM's tent and say hello. The American robin is one of the most common birds in North America. You've probably seen one in your backyard or been woken up by one before sunrise. But did you know this iconic bird is also Wisconsin's state bird? For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effects expert Nunez is joined by Aubrey Folsis, an environmental educator at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She shares facts about the American robin and how it became a symbol for the state.
This month marks 76 years since the American robin became Wisconsin's state bird. So for today's episode of Chirp Chat, I thought it'd be nice to highlight this classic songbird. So Aubrey, I'm curious, how did the American robin become Wisconsin's state bird in the first place?
So the American robin became our state bird going all the way back in 1926 when the State Federation of Women's Clubs sponsored a bird study program in Wisconsin public schools. So they basically sponsored a program so children can learn more about the birds that they see in their neighborhoods. And part of that program was allowing the kids to vote for a state bird. And the robin received twice as many votes as any other bird. So it was really those school children who chose it in 1926, but it did not become the official state bird by, you know, government decree until 1949.
Wow. Okay. So imagine if everything was just picked by second graders.
I mean, the world would be maybe a better place if they could just choose all of our state everything.
So is Wisconsin the only state that claims the robin or the American robin as its state bird?
There are a couple other states. Michigan and Connecticut also have the American robin. And the American robin can be found in almost every single state in the United States. It's found all over the continent of North America. Wow. So pretty much any state could lay a claim to it if they wanted to.
So can you describe some of the characteristics of the American robin?
So the American robin, it's one of our larger songbirds, and it's very visible, especially in the spring and summer, because it is a ground forager. So it's going to be hopping around the ground. It really loves short grasses. And it's part of the thrush family. So it's actually closely related to birds like bluebirds. And then some of our more elusive wood thrush and hermit thrush, which are its relatives you really only find tucked away in the forest. It has a bright orange-ish underbelly, chest and belly, and then a slate gray wings, and then a darker head.
And you said it's part of the thrush family. Does that have anything to do with how beautiful its song is?
Yes. So thrushes are really known for their music, their songs that they make. And part of the reason they're able to do that is they actually are able to sing using multiple vocal cords. So they can sing multiple notes at once and kind of layer them on top of each other to create this really melodious warbling sound. It's a very clear tone, very beautiful, lots of different notes that they go in between.
And so I personally find the American Robin, and this could be a hot take, but I find it underrated. Growing up in Arizona, for me, like you said, they're found pretty everywhere all over the country, mm-hmm. but I didn't really notice them growing up. So something that I like about them is watching them forage for food.
Yes.
So that leads me to my next question is, what type of food do they eat?
So robins, they really eat kind of two main food groups. They eat a lot of our like softer invertebrates. So think earthworms, slugs, things like that. And then they also really love berries. So in the spring and summer, once the ground thaws, they're going to be all over the ground searching for those worms that they're able to peck out with their beak. And they really search for them using visual cues, but there is some studies that think that they listen for them a little bit as well. It's kind of a really hot debate in the science world. It's a lot of scientists are trying to figure out how exactly do they know exactly where those worms are underground. And yeah, I also think they're underrated. I think we almost take them for granted because they're so common here, and they are one of the most common songbirds in North America. And once you start looking for them, you really do see them all over the place. And they're very fun to watch when they're hopping around.
Yeah.
They turn their head to look down using one of their eyes to really like peer in and look for those bugs and pull them up. So
yeah, I think it's really interesting how they're so common yet so complex that mm-hmm. there's still stuff that we don't know about them.
Yes.
So when I moved to Wisconsin, I've heard that some people believe that American robins are the first sign of spring. But are they really? Or can you tell me about their migration patterns?
So robins do migrate, but their migration can be anywhere from a really short migration distance where they just join a flock and hang out in the woods as opposed to in a park or a backyard. Or it can be a long migration where they're traveling from Canada all the way down to the southern United States. It really depends kind of on the bird, on the region that they're in. So in our area in Wisconsin, we do see them all year long. We just see them in different habitats. So in the wintertime, we will get flocks of 15 to 20 robins who will hang out kind of deep in the forest. And that's because they're looking for berries. Mm. So they're going to be moving to where the food is. So they might have to travel a little bit further away to get to those berries because that's mainly their source of food in the wintertime.
That makes sense. So worms in the spring and summer, berries in the winter.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So something else that is interesting about them, and you mentioned this, is their abundance.
Yes.
So how does that even happen? Like, why is there so many American robins here?
American robins are a great story of adaptation. They love foraging in short grass. And think of how much short grass we have now in our backyards, in our parks, in pretty much everywhere. Anywhere we mow the lawn, the robins are like, oh, that's a great place to forage. So they've really adapted well to being in urban and suburban environments. They also will build their nests. Now, normally they'll build their nests in shorter trees, but they can build them on eaves or in gutters. You know, they're really not too picky about where they're building their nests, which also helps them adapt. So they really can be found in a lot of areas that humans have kind of taken over. We haven't really pushed them out. Another reason is because they actually can have 1 to 3 broods of babies a year.
Oh, wow.
So basically they can raise 3 different sets of babies in a season, whereas a lot of other songbirds maybe only raise 1. So that just also really helps their numbers out.
Yeah, a lot of baby robins out there.
A lot. And they're one of the earliest to start as well, which is why people think of them as a sign of spring, because they are one of the first songbirds to start breeding. So mm-hmm. you start to hear them in March and they're already laying eggs by April.
And their calls must be, you know, their mating calls.
Yes. And then the males are the only ones who sing, and they will sing as soon as there's a little bit of light in the sky, I've been woken up at 4 a.m. by robins outside my window before, and they like to sing all day long, attracting females to their territory.
Yeah. And going back a little bit to their characteristics, that reminded me, is there a visual difference between the males and females?
There is. It's not like really, really bold compared to some other songbirds. The big visual difference is the females are a little bit more pale. So they're not quite as a bold coloration. Their heads are a little bit lighter as opposed to kind of the dark, almost black heads of the male. But you really have to pause and watch them for a while to tell, although it is only the females that sit on the nest. So if you do see a nest, it's going to be the mom on the eggs.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So back to what we were talking about with the abundance of robins or American robins, that wasn't always the case, was it? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about that?
So they, along with a lot of other birds, saw a big drop in their populations due to DDT. So a common pesticide that was used pre-1970 because it affected bugs. And as we know, a lot of robins, you know, that's their main diet and that's what they're feeding their chicks. That's what they're eating. So that caused a great decline in their populations. But with the banning of DDT and then with their ability to just kind of adapt to, you know, urban areas, their populations have really rebounded. Now, they do still face some issues with pesticides because they're foraging in people's lawns. So if people are using a lot of pesticides or herbicides in their lawns, that can also affect the robins as well.
Hmm. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind for people listening. Okay, so I kind of want to go into some ideas of, you know, if the American robin wasn't Wisconsin state bird, what could be?
Yeah.
I looked into this and I pulled up a blog post from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. They said, can eBird help choose better state birds?
Yeah.
And so they looked at eBird data to find unique connections between the states and the birds that live there. And they suggested that the rose-breasted grosbeak would be a great pick as Wisconsin state bird. What do you think?
So I do love the rose-breasted grosbeak. And I also did a little research and read that study. And the reason they chose that is because we have the highest breeding population of rose-breasted grosbeaks. But that's more in the northern part of the state. We do get them here, but they're a little bit less common. One thing I love about the American robin is its accessibility. Anybody can see an American robin. You don't have to go voyage into the forest or go to a unique habitat to see one. It's a bird that anyone can see just by looking in their backyard. And that's how people get into birding, is by just noticing what birds live in their neighborhood. And that's what I love about robins. So while I do love rose-breasted grosbeaks, they are a little bit less common. So yeah, that would be my only stickler with maybe choosing them, is because we don't see them as often, at least in this part of the state. They're a little bit more common up north.
No, yeah, I think that is a valid take. And I wonder, have you talked to like other birders about this before? Like, have you heard other takes from other people?
Yeah, so we've been discussing this. it's an interesting concept. So state birds, like I said, the robin, it is a state bird for a couple of other states. It'd be nice if we could, you know, choose something a little bit more unique. And I personally would love if our state bird could be reflective of our relationship with the water, our relationship with the Great Lakes, with all of our different lakes and ponds and rivers. But I also still want it to be accessible. So something like even a simple mallard or a great blue heron, you know, something that might be a little bit more common to see, but still relies on our lakes and wetlands, I think would be interesting. We've heard some push for maybe like a sandhill crane, because we do have the International Crane Foundation that works really hard on, you know, upping their populations. And they're a really, really fun bird in the state as well. It's tough because you want it to be something that people can see, but then you still want it to be something that is special to our state.
Right. That's representative of who we are as Wisconsinites. So we have reached the end of Chirp Chat. I usually ask people to highlight a bird for the month, but I do want to ask you, what do you think should be Wisconsin state bird?
I mean, it's a tough question because I love all birds. And I do think the robin is a lot of fun. I do think it does make a good state bird because it's so accessible. But my vote, like I said, I want it to be reflective of our relationship with the lakes and be accessible. So I might just have to go with the mallard. You know, a good old-fashioned duck that you find out at the ponds and at the parks.
Can you describe the mallard?
Yes. So mallards are kind of the quintessential wild duck. The males have that bright green head. The females are going to be a little bit more brown, drab colored. And they are very common in our waterways. They do migrate, but they can also stick around if they can get enough food because they're omnivores. So you really can find them in some places all year long if the water's not frozen. And, you know, ducklings are just some of the cutest birds you can see.
I think the mallard is a great pick. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed that. So yeah, Aubrey, thanks again for telling me about the American robin and helping me learn more. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I love talking birds.
Aubrey Fulsis is an environmental educator and the family programs lead at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat, which you can find as a podcast wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. And just like Chirp Chat, Lake Effect is also a podcast. Download episodes and listen to us on demand while you're on the go. In about 15 minutes, we'll tell you about a decades-long Madison tradition that brings people to the Capitol Square, not in protest, but to join together around music. But first, we'll learn about the science behind the summer solstice, which is tomorrow. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The weather heated up in Milwaukee this week, but it's not yet the official start of summer. Tomorrow, June 20th, is the summer solstice, which is both the longest day and shortest night in the Northern Hemisphere. So what's the difference between astronomical summer and meteorological summer? And what makes the solstice so special all around the world? Our astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, joins me now to explain, beginning with what causes this astronomical event known as the summer solstice.
So the sun moves along our horizon, and that's principally because the Earth is tilted, but I won't bother with the conversation with the Earth is tilted. The real thing is that what we see is that the height of the sun changes, and its location of sunrise and sunset also shifts over the course of the year. And even ancient people all over the world noticed that the sun does this thing where every day it moves north in the northern hemisphere, actually in the southern hemisphere too. It moves north a little bit every day in terms of its sunrise and sunset location. And then it maxes out. It kind of looks like it's still, which is why it's called solstice, that the moment here the sun is paused, it's northernward motion, and then it starts moving south. So that's why it's called solstice. On that day, the sun changes direction.
So is there any connection, or is this on this solstice day, is that an example of like the true high noon where the sun is at its peak, at its highest position in the sky?
So we have the whole business that muddies the water with time. Like, are we on standard or daytime? Because that adds an hour. But at high noon, the sun is going to be highest on the summer solstice.
Excellent. So this marks the start of what is astronomical summer, the solstice here. But what is the difference between astronomical summer and what we often think of in our brains and planning-wise as meteorological summer?
The fact that the sun is highest doesn't necessarily mean that the temperature is going to be highest, right? However, as the days have been getting noticeably longer, it does get a little warmer. So for those of us who have spent All winter and a lot of what people around here call spring being cold, usually by the 1st of June, there is a noticeable increase in our temperature. So that's what's called the beginning of meteorological summer. And if you want to know when the highest temperatures are, they typically are about a month after the summer solstice. So now the sun is up for so many hours a day, consistently, our air, our ground, everything warms up, but it takes a little while. So you need to wait for a few weeks before the average temperature is going to be at its highest.
You're talking about some of the visual and the physical cues that we feel as like the shift of summer is truly into effect. But around the time of the summer solstice, which this year is on Friday, June 20th, is there any like kind of fun home experiments or anything that you would recommend we simply observe outside as a consequence of this astronomical event?
Well, if you're lucky enough to have a eastern horizon view, then it's fun to wake up. I mean, it does require you waking up earlier and earlier, of course, but there is value in just, I don't know, to connect to that celestial, right? For a few days, watch the sun and put a marker on your window. You know, that tree, that door, that across the street, the window, whatever it is, and you'll be able to see that the sun is moving. And even if you don't have a clean eastern horizon viewpoint, well, it rises over that tree. Just notice, where is it the first time that you can see the sun? And if you don't have an eastern horizon, maybe you're able to do that on the western horizon. Where is it setting? It'll be as far north as it sets. And I think for many people, in fact, I've had people ask me about this, how come when I'm driving to work on certain times of the year, the sun is in my face, and other times it's just completely not an issue? Again, that reminds us the sun moves. It's not always in the same place at sunrise or sunset or even any time of the day.
You mentioned ancient cultures and peoples have been noticing this change for quite some time. Can you share with me, like, what's some of the earliest recorded elements of the summer solstice that you have studied or referenced as an astronomer, how far back this goes? Because Stonehenge is kind of built around the solstice, right? So this is going way back?
Even further back. In Egypt, there is a monument called Nabta Playa. It was built almost 9,000 years ago. And we feel that, we think that based on how the building is aligned, it was aligned to match the position of the sun's rising on the summer solstice. So this kind of calendar was hardwired around the world when you had no, I mean, there were no other ways of doing this, right? So the sun was the marker for both the day when it rises and sets, but over longer periods of time also, the whole shape of the year. And people used it, not just, you know, this wasn't just, oh, let's make cool buildings. It was, you know, now we need to put our crops in. Now we need to have harvested whatever we're going to harvest because, you know, the weather changes significantly. So I think the fact that we have so directly connected the celestial with daily activities is just a fascinating aspect that I wish we did more of. I mean, people are impacted by what the sun is doing. They say, you know, it's so bright. They forget their glasses. They're not paying attention. If they paid more attention, they'd realize, oh, the sun is really high. I really need my sunglasses because I get, you know, dizzy by all the reflection, right? All the light around me. Or, I'm not getting enough sunlight. I need to get out for the precious hours that it is up and make the most of it. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And there's scales big and small with how this event is marked around the world. What are some of your favorites, or what do you plan on personally doing to mark the summer solstice?
Well, I'm, of course, like a party like anybody else. A good friend of mine is having a solstice party. So there are parties around the world. So in places in far northern Europe, where in the wintertime it really is a drag because the days are so short, you can imagine how what joy comes with the summer solstice, because now it's 24 hours or many hours of daytime. And people celebrate that and, you know, the renewal of life and joy and light. So that is important both for the summer and the winter solstice, because there is a bit of sadness in the summer solstice, and that is tomorrow it's going to be a shorter day, right? Whereas the winter solstice, it leaves, at least you know, tomorrow is going to be a longer day, a brighter day. So the only thing I can say to comfort us is that it will continue to get warmer after the summer solstice.
Well, I want to just say happy summer solstice to you, and thank you for joining me to share more about the science behind it.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Always a pleasure.
Jean Creighton is our regular astronomy contributor and the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. You can find more of our astronomy conversations at wuwm.com. In about 15 minutes, we'll bring you a new episode of Bubbler Talk. This one is about the origins of the popular Wisconsin card game, Sheep's Head. And just like we've got a new episode coming up on Lake Effect, we've also just got a new season of Bubbler Talk going on, and we need some new questions from you. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. Coming up after the break, we'll tell you about Madison's tradition of concerts on the square and help you plan a trip to see one of them. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. With so many music festivals happening throughout the summer in Wisconsin, it can be hard to pick which ones to attend. There's one that's been a long-standing tradition in the Madison area for more than four decades. Concerts on the Square brings thousands of people to the Capitol Square for six free concerts in the summer. The area around the Capitol becomes a patchwork of picnic blankets as people gather to enjoy food, friends, and an array of music. Joe Lanis is the CEO of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, which puts on the concert series. The first one is next Wednesday, June 25th. Ahead of that, Lanis and Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin join Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen.
I'd first like to start with what I thought was a very interesting connection between concerts on the square and American Girl Doll. Joe, can you share the origin story of this concert series?
Yeah, back in 1983, so 42 years ago, the founder of American Girl, Pleasant Roland, she had an office on the square in downtown Madison and apparently looked over at the Capitol at 5 o'clock on some weeknight and said, you know, there should be people down there listening to music. I think I want to start a concert series. So being the entrepreneur that she was, she talked to the city and other stakeholders, and over the course of 1983, put together a plan to do a free classical music concert series in downtown Madison, starting the last Wednesday of June. And it was going to start in 1984. And she pulled all the pieces together, and the very first concert was that last Wednesday in June 1984, where about 5,000 to 7,000 people showed up for a free live classical music concert. And she followed up that week with five more that summer. And 42 years later, the founder of American Girl, her tradition of concerts on the square is still alive and strong here in Madison.
So how has the series grown and changed over those 42 years?
What's really interesting about the series, what hasn't changed is six free concerts starting the last Wednesday in June. I think what has changed is certainly the growth of the series in terms of the number of people. Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra has sometimes upwards of 60,000 people that attend one concert. So the audiences have grown so much so that people will be on the State Street side of the Capitol, which is the opposite side of the Capitol, just having a picnic and listening to the concert. I also think one of the biggest changes is the program evolution. So our music director, Andrew Sewell, is celebrating 26 years with us this summer. And when he started, the concert series was pretty traditional, like Sousa marches, classical music, fast, kind of pomp and circumstance. And he's really evolved the program to include a little bit of everything for everybody. So we have Pops Nights, we have our 4th of July program, we do cross-cultural collaborations, we bring in local artists. So he's really curated a really compelling program that speaks, I think, to everybody's interests at some point in the summer. But sort of the, in addition to the six Wednesdays in summer, the picnic atmosphere, the community atmosphere, the vendors, the partners, it really is one big picnic really brought together by the entire community.
Yeah. Can you describe what the Capitol Square looks like and feels like on a night there is a concert happening? What's the atmosphere like?
A really unique and sort of symbolic feature of the series is the blankets. So if you can picture, if you've been at the Capitol Square, around the entire square is the lawn, the grass around the Capitol. On concert night, more or less every square inch of the lawn is covered by a blanket. So patrons will come out at 2 in the afternoon or 3 in the afternoon to reserve their seat on the lawn by placing a blanket. So when you show up, it's just a tapestry of blankets and people setting up these amazing picnic displays of cheese boards and wine and low chairs. And this happens every square inch of the Capitol lawn. We have 20 food trucks so you can kind of smell all the food that's being cooked. Before the concert starts, there's like a vibe of anticipation. So there's some background music playing in the speakers and you can just feel the energy slowly build 6 o'clock, 6:15. And then when the concert starts and we introduce the show, everybody just goes nuts because I think as of now, 42 years in, there's three generations sometimes on the blankets that have attended concerts on the square. So it really has become a part of the fabric of Madison and what it makes it so great to live here. So there's nothing quite like it. It's a free concert and there's 50,000 people just seeing old friends and seeing family and just enjoying a great night of music.
So Amanda, I'll turn to you now. Summer is a great time to go to Madison. So if people are in town for a concert and want to check out some of the other things that Madison has to offer, what would you recommend they do on a summertime visit?
Well, there is so much to do, Becky. First of all, I would definitely recommend you lay down your blanket, you reserve your spot on the Capitol Square for the concert. But once you have your blanket down, it's a great time to go explore some shopping downtown before the concert kicks off. You're right there on the iconic State Street that leads from the Capitol Square all the way to the University of Wisconsin campus. And it's lined with diverse local retail and restaurants. So that's a great place to check out. You'll want to stop into Fromagination too. That's right on the Capitol Square. And that's a European style cut to order cheese shop that showcases award-winning Wisconsin artisan cheese. So maybe you'll want to get some local snacks to take back for your picnic while you're enjoying the concert. But I also really recommend that you get out on the water. So Madison is built on an isthmus, and that's a narrow strip of land with water on either side. So there are some really great opportunities to enjoy lakes right downtown. Madison Boats has four different locations where you can rent out kayaks, stand-up paddle boards. They also have fishing and pontoon boats to get out and enjoy Lake Wingra, Lake Mendota, and Lake Monona. And Madison is also known for being one of the most bikeable cities in the country. It's a platinum-level bicycle-friendly community and home to more than 200 miles of scenic biking and hiking trails. So you can rent an e-bike from Madison B-Cycle. They have a number of different stations downtown. And a really popular route is the Lake Monona Loop. It's a fully paved 13-mile loop that offers some unbeatable views of Lake Monona and the Madison skyline.
And Madison also offers a variety of free museums and tours. So what can you tell me about those?
Again, there are so many to choose from. If you have never done a tour of the Wisconsin State Capitol, that is certainly one that I recommend. They have free tours offered daily. They start at the information desk on the ground floor of the Capitol Rotunda. I also think a lot of people don't know you can tour the governor's mansion. They have free tours in the summer months, but also during the holiday season. So that's a really fun one to check out. If you're an art lover, there's the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, as well as the Chazen Museum of Art. There's also the Wisconsin Veterans Museum and UW-Madison's Geology Museum, which I think is a hidden gem here in Madison. And Olbrich Botanical Gardens is another great one. So they have outdoor gardens as well as the Bolts Conservancy. The Conservancy does have a small fee some days, but it's free Wednesday and Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon. And the outdoor garden is always free. They have 16 acres with a really diverse collection of plants, including a royal Thai pavilion and garden. Now, this pavilion was actually a gift to the University of Wisconsin-Madison from the Thai government and the Thai chapter of the Wisconsin Alumni Association, because UW-Madison has one of the largest Thai student populations of any U.S. college or university. And what's even more unique about this is that the pavilion is one of only four located outside of Thailand. So it's really a true gem that's available for free for the public to visit in the beautiful Olbrich Gardens.
All right, let's talk patios. Where can people go to eat or drink while enjoying the summer weather in Madison?
UW-Madison's Union Terrace is certainly a favorite spot for lots of locals as well as visitors. That's where you're going to enjoy those iconic sunburst chairs. You get beautiful lake views. There are gorgeous sunsets there, and you can enjoy some good food. I would make sure that you get some Babcock ice cream while you're there. It is made from the dairy plant on campus, and they actually use milk from the cows that live on the university's farm right on campus. So really fun connection to Wisconsin's dairy industry and the university. Another great option is Great Dane Pub and Brewing Company. They have a few different locations in Madison, but their downtown location has a beautiful tucked away outdoor beer garden in back that really is going to make you feel like you're in a totally different place. I also recommend the beer garden at Olbrich Park. They are open daily, and the menu includes a list of craft beer, cider, and seltzer. Plus, they have locally sourced snacks like giant pretzels from Clausen's European Bakery, which I highly recommend. It is dog friendly, and it's also really easy to get to by bike if you take the Lake Monona Loop.
There are a lot of outdoor music concerts and festivals to choose from in the summer. So for both of you, why would you recommend that people make the concerts on the square a priority? What sets it apart?
I think one thing that really stands out for concerts on the square is its history of 42 years. I think it has this sense of it's been here a long time vibe. And I think the backdrop of the Capitol, the picnic nature of it, there's something about the Midwest and Madison. I mean, setting your blanket down at 3 o'clock, putting your belongings there, and then going back to your office. It's definitely a Midwestern vibe thing. And there's just this sense of community that I think really speaks to music at its core. Like, the point of music is to bring people together and to have these shared experiences. And what's great about Concerts on the Square is it has such a variety of music. It's not just classical music. And we really attract, I think, all of Madison to come down. So it gives you an opportunity to see just everybody in Madison. I mean, it's such a large event, and you can just experience downtown Madison together with the entire community. And I think that's what really sets it apart. It is in the heart of Madison. It is such a large event. It has so much history, and just the picnic nature of it makes it very connective. People, you just feel like one big family outing, I guess, but it's not 10 people, it's 50,000 people.
I would add, Concerts on the Square really is a quintessential celebration of summer in Madison. And I love that for many, it's really a very approachable introduction to the Madison Chamber Orchestra. It's this amazing opportunity to experience live music, but it's also a very laid back social atmosphere. And as Joe said, just with that beautiful Wisconsin Capitol as a backdrop, it's an all around very unique, memory worthy experience.
Right. Amanda and Joe, thank you for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us. Great conversation.
Amanda Weibel is the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin. Joe Lanis is the CEO of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra. They both joined Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen for our regular series, Wandering Wisconsin. You can find more information about concerts on the square, including a schedule of performers, at wuwm.com.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM reporter Catherine Kokel. Today on Bubbler Talk, we're talking Sheepshead. When Jeff Williams moved back to Wisconsin after decades away, he joined a men's social group to make friends.
And the first thing that they asked me, one of the guys asked was, do you play Sheepshead? And I said, no. And he said, well, what good are you?
Williams grew up in southwestern Wisconsin, but he'd never learned how to play our state's unofficial official card game. That had to change. Williams learned the game and has now been playing it for 20 years. All of this got him thinking.
Where did this game come from? Why were there so many different rules and variations? Why so many people are interested in Sheepshead in this part of Wisconsin?
I jumped at the chance to answer his question. For me, Sheepshead stirs up warm memories of all the adults throwing nickels around the kitchen table under a hazy light. But like Williams, I never learned how to play the game myself. So I rounded up some of the best Sheepshead players I know, my parents and their friends, and my mom took the lead in catching me up on how to play.
You start with 32 cards, sevens and up, and the idea is to take as many tricks and as many points as you can.
This is where I should probably tell you I'm not going to teach you how to play Sheepshead in this story. We simply don't have enough time for that.
This seems kind of complicated.
It's a little bit
for like a game people play on their lunch breaks.
Here's my best attempt at explaining Sheepshead. Players on two teams take turns playing the cards in their hands to compete for points. The teams are formed at the start of the game when one person takes the cards in the blind and calls out a card for their partner. Only the partner knows that they have that called card and are therefore on a team with the picker. Sheepshead creates a unique suit of cards called the Trump Suit that allows those cards to supersede all others. Williams wanted to know why the Sheepshead lingo and rules vary so much depending on who you're playing with. For that, I turned to Eric Gunter. He is a first-generation German-American who ran the Sheepshead tournament at Milwaukee's German Fest for several years. He confirms that some of it actually falls along geographical lines.
We play, you know, Milwaukee Sheepshead. Milwaukee Sheepshead, you call an ace for a partner. A lot of places around the state, you play Jack of Diamonds is the partner. So whoever's holding the Jack of Diamonds, that's your partner for that hand.
Then there are the house rules. I stopped by a Sheepshead tournament held at the Sussex VFW to understand more about formal Sheepshead play.
Oh, Jiminy Cricket.
More than 30 people had gathered to play in the tournament. There's no cracking your knuckles on the table to double the stakes. And if you make a mistake, you owe the other players some of your points. Next came the more mysterious part of William's question. Where did Sheepshead come from anyway? Gunther explains that the game originated in Germany and was brought to Wisconsin by immigrants working in factories or doing manual labor. As for the name Sheepshead, there's actually no livestock involved.
It's not really Sheepshead. It's Schafkopf, and it's a Bavarian game. It's a poor person's game. You know, a Schaf in German can be a sheep, but the way it's spelled, it's the end of a barrel, the flat end of the barrel. So you stand a barrel up, and you sit around it, and you play the game with four people on top of the barrel head. So in the translation, Schaf became sheep and became Sheepshead.
I brought all of this information back to Bubbler Talk question asker Jeff Williams. Did that answer his question?
Sure, that absolutely does. And that's pretty cool. I like the idea of inverted barrel as a place to play cards.
So whether you play for nickels or quarters, on the bottom of a barrel or around a kitchen table, at the end of the day, it's all the same. It's Wisconsin Sheepshead. Well, actually, it's Schafkopf.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your questions.
And Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grit Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Catherine Kokel, Taryn Powell, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Maria Peralta Arellano from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take us on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon when we'll meet the new head of Milwaukee's Office of African American Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.